I'd like to bring the House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Accountability to order. Colleagues, we do have a pretty full chart today, but there's a few bills that are on our agenda, and I believe that the last posted agenda that we will not be doing today, essentially. So I'm going to try to brief the audience on that. If you're here for House Bill 3624, we're not going to be entertaining that bill today. House Bill 3658, we will not be entertaining that bill today. And House Bill 3689, we will not be entertaining that bill today. And so with that, I'm going to start out a little bit out of order, so I apologize for that, but it's pretty common for me to be out of order. So with that, I'm going to House Bill 3659 first, and no one signed up. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3659, and I'm going to close a public hearing on House Bill 3659. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3659. Patrick, could you give us a brief little summary of the bill and the amendment that's before us?
Absolutely, Mr. Chair. Thank you. We heard this bill last Thursday. This is a bill that originally was dealing with the issue of health insurance rescission. Last Thursday, we heard a briefing from Tom Jovic, who is here in the audience. If the committee has any questions on it, that briefing was on an amendment, the dash two in your packets, which will replace the original measure. That measure establishes a temporary high-risk pool program and specifies that the program is to be administered by OMIP. It authorizes Oregon Health Authority to seek approval from U.S. Department of Health and Human Services to obtain federal funding for the program, becomes operative upon receipt of that federal approval. It would sunset January 2nd, 2016, and would take effect upon passage and signature as per the emergency clause in the Dash 2 Amendment. I have that I'll be handing out momentarily here as soon as I'm done talking the fiscal statement and the revenue statement for the Dash 2s. The fiscal is just received. It may still be warm from the copier, in fact. We've been told that that with the Dash 2s, a Ways and Means referral is in order, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Question?
Representative Wisniak, question?
Yes, sir. Patrick said it, I thought our previous testimony, it was going to sunset in 2014.
I believe Mr. Jovic's in. If you'd like to come ahead and come up on the Dash 2 amendment to House Bill 3659. Just give Patrick a minute to get these handed out, and we'll get to you, Mr. Representative Wisniak.
Thank you.
Patrick, I believe the question Representative Wisniak posed is about the sunset date on this, whether he was inquiring whether it was 2014, and I thought it was 2016. Maybe.
For the record, my name is Tom Jovic. I'm the administrator of the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool. The bill sunsets in 2016. The 2014 date is, as far as we know, the point at which a larger national universal health coverage program would begin. And if the federal government makes funds available to the states to run a temporary high-risk pool, it would go through 2013. The 2016 date gives us the authority to continue in the event that the federal government continues that program.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisniak.
Thank you. Follow-up question then. Permission, but how about the funds?
Well, only if the funds are available would the program continue. There are no state funds in this program. There are no assessments of state health insurance companies like there are for OMIP. It's all based on federal funds and premiums collected from enrollees. So if the federal funds stop, this program stops.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move to adopt the House Bill 3659-2, amendment dated February 5th.
Representative Riley moves to adopt the House Bill 3659-2, amendment dated February 5th. Is there any discussion?
Yes, right.
I'm not seeing any discussion. Cindy, could you call the roll, please?
Representative Krieger?
Yeah.
Representative Matthews?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Representative Wisnett?
Aye.
Representative Winger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Gilliam?
Aye.
Vice Chair Riley?
Aye.
Chair
Aye. House Bill 3659-2 amendments are adopted. Representative Riley.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3659 as amended to the floor.
Mr. Chair, are you not entertaining any more amendments to this bill?
Representative Riley has the floor. We just adopted the dash two amendments. Patrick, do you want to?
A motion has not been made. If the chair is permitted to take a motion from the person who wishes it,
that may. Yes. Well, it was the chair's intent to move the dash two amendments and move that on to Ways and Means, but in light that Representative Riley hasn't finished his motion, I would accept a motion on another amendment if you'd like.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move the dash three amendments to House Bill 3659.
I'm going to stand at ease for just a moment. So I'd like to reconvene the House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Accountability. We're in work session on House Bill 3659. We have adopted the Dash 2 amendments. Representative Wingert has moved the Dash 3 amendments, which I understand are completely unrelated to the bill, and was trying to figure out if what would happen if we could adopt the two. And although we don't have the fiscal on the Dash 3 amendments, they could be adopted together. So that's a clarification that I wanted to have. So Representative Winger has moved to adopt House Bill 3659-3 amendments dated February 5th, 2010. Discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Winger.
Just for a point of explanation, the Dash 3 amendments in front of the committee would allow Oregonians to deduct from their tax liability, or actually as a deduction, all the costs of their health insurance premiums and other health care related costs. This was a bill that did appear in the last session, and I actually have, I'll hand out this email that I got. It's just one example from a random Oregonian who heard about this bill from last session and was hoping that we would pass it again. There are a lot of Oregonians out there struggling to pay their health care bills, and this is an opportunity to provide them some relief. I can't think of anything more than maybe a handful of bills being considered this session that would do more to help Oregonians out, and I hope the committee will support the amendment.
Thank you. Representative Winger, do you know what the federal deduction is allowed for health care insurance premiums?
I'm not aware that the federal government has a competing or a complementary statute like this, although it would be nice if the federal government added this to the federal tax code, but it's a good start in Oregon.
But to your knowledge, it would be a departure from our federal tax code.
Yes, Mr. Chair, that's true. But we have a little bit of latitude there because last session we chose to disconnect from the federal tax code. So we are in many ways on our own already.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Smith.
Do we have some understanding of how much this would impact the Oregon budget?
I'm sure it would have an impact, but we do not know how much at this point, Representative Smith.
I'm a little concerned that that the first time hearing of the amendment, seeing it, is after we're called into work session, not in our packet, submitted. I'm seeing hand signals where it sort of seems to me like what's happening in this room is a move to get a vote on the record on an issue not as distinct from some other objective. And the... And it disturbs me a little bit, not even, setting aside the content, I'm a little bit curious about the process.
Thank you, Representative Smith. It was sent out as soon as it became available, and Representative Winger did make that available to the committee administrator, and it was sent out as soon as possible. I think it is a fair proposal that we look at this amendment. However, the timing of it is such with the Dash 2 amendments, in my opinion, which is a very important bill to prepare Oregon to accept some large amounts of federal funds. I believe it was estimated at $20 million in this next biennium. I think timing is really important on this particular issue, and though it may be worthy of a good conversation, I'm not sure I'll be supporting the amendment, the Dash 3 amendment. So, any other discussion?
I have a question.
Representative Smith.
Can we move the amendment without a fiscal of the amendment?
Yes, we can.
But we couldn't move the bill
We could not move the bill. You are correct. No further discussion. Cindy, would you call the roll, please?
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Matthews?
No.
Representative Smith?
No.
No.
Representative
Whitman?
Aye.
Representative Winger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Gilliam?
Aye.
Vice Chair Riley?
No.
Chair Holby?
No. The dash 3 amendment, having not received the required vote, is failed.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Wingard.
I would move the dash 4 amendments to House Bill 3659.
Representative Wingard moves the dash 4 amendments, dash 4 amendments to House Bill 3659. I was trying to speed that process up a little bit. Is there any discussion?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Representative Wingard.
Well, for a point of explanation, this is another great amendment to this bill to, in this case, to help out the public employees of the state of Oregon. This bill would require PEB to offer a fully funded health savings account option to public employees among the insurance options that are available to them. This is something that OWEB does for the teachers, and again, another bill from last session that unfortunately didn't make it through the process, but I believe that this bill is a win-win-win all around. I believe the taxpayers will see savings in the health care cost to public employees over the long term, and that public employees will benefit as well, as a great many of them will see an additional savings account accrue from this mechanism. Anybody who's familiar with how health savings accounts operate will understand just what a great boon this would be as an option. And again, nobody would be required within the public employee system to take it if they didn't want to. It just simply asks PEB to offer that to public employees as an option. And I would encourage everyone to support that.
Thank you. Any other discussion? Representative Smith.
Mr. Chair, I'll be very brief. The these both seem, as the previous amendment and this one, both seem like ideas that merit not only their own bills, but their own hearings and their own significant debate. We were each given a one bill expectation for this special of special sessions, and I am a little concerned that we try to subvert that one bill limitation by putting entire ideas into bills that happen to have broad relating to clauses that allow it, but don't necessarily invite it or even be or even consistent with the idea.
Thank you.
On the amendment.
Thank you, Representative Smith. Any other discussion? Was that a hand?
Yes,
Representative Gilliam?
Mr. Chair.
Just caught it out of the corner of my eye. Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to understand, with or without the dash fours, this bill will head for further vetting in Ways and Means in this session. That's the intention.
That is correct.
Thank you.
Further discussion? Seeing none, Cindy, will you call the roll on the dash 4 amendments that have been proposed by Representative Wingard?
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Matthews?
No.
Representative Smith?
No.
Representative Tomei?
No.
Representative Wisnett?
Aye.
Representative Wingard?
Aye.
Vice Chair Gilliam?
Aye.
Vice Chair Riley?
No.
Chair Colby.
No. The dash 4 amendments to House Bill 3659, having not received the required votes, has failed. Representative Riley.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3659 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Representative Riley moves that House Bill 3659, as amended, to the floor with a due pass recommendation that be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Cindy, will you call the roll, please?
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Matthews?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Representative Wisnett?
Aye.
Representative
Wingard? Aye.
Vice Chair Gilliam?
Aye.
Vice Chair Riley?
Aye.
Chair Colby?
Aye. House Bill 3659, having received the required votes, passes to the Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Thank you, Committee. Let's figure out what we're going to do now. Smith? Yeah. Next up, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3694.
A brief explanation of 3694, Mr. Chair?
Yes, please.
Thank you. House Bill 3694 authorizes residential landlords to continue to use or to revert to using a separately charged pro-rata apportionment billing method for water or sewer services if such billing method was used for tenants on the premises immediately before a statutory change that restricted the use of the billing method. This measure has an emergency clause, would take effect upon passage and signature by the governor. We have in your packets a -1 amendment. The -1s clarify that a pro-rata apportionment billing arrangement must be charged separately for all tenants. It changes the bill language referencing tenants in the premises to tenants in the facility, and also deletes the changes that the bill would make to ORS 90.532 subsection 3.
Thank you. First up, we have Brian Bowe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Brian Bowe, and I'm here this afternoon representing CalAmp Properties. Thank you for taking the time in this abbreviated session to deal with this matter. House Bill 3694 relating to pro-rata billing for water and sewer services in manufactured housing communities. Last session, this committee dealt with two bills related to how water and sewer billing were to be handled in manufactured housing communities. Senate Bill 772 contained a provision that prohibited manufactured housing park owners from converting their water and sewer billing to a pro-rata system. A pro-rata system is a system where the total monthly water sewer billing is divided by the number of tenants, and the resulting amount is attached as a line item to the monthly rent bill. The other bill the committee dealt with, Senate Bill 929, established a date certain when all manufactured housing communities of a certain size must convert to sub-meter billing for water and sewer. And sub-metering is a metering system attached to each unit in the park that measures the exact water and usage for that unit. House Bill 3694 is a technical fix of sorts to the language adopted in 722 relating to pro-rata billing. This unanticipated issue arose around the language that grandfathered in those parks currently using the pro-rata system prior to the conversion to sub-meters in 2012. The language allowed those parks to continue using pro-rata but failed to address new tenants moving in after the effective date of the bill but prior to the conversion to sub-metering. Under the existing language in SB 722, those tenants would have to pay an estimate of the monthly utility costs folded into the monthly rent. HB 3694 simply corrects this oversight and allows new tenants in a manufactured housing community park where all the other tenants are currently on a pro-rata system to be billed in the same manner. Again, this would be operative only for the period of time prior to the transition to sub-metering. This change is important to CalAmp as it avoids a situation where tenants who are on similar sites receiving similar services would appear to be paying different rental rates. And that's the conclusion of my written testimony. Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions and urge the passage of the measure.
Thank you, Mr. Bowe. I do have a question or a clarification from your testimony. So the sub-metering will take effect in 2012, I believe you said?
Yes, for it currently, for its scheduled
and
purposes.
And will that apply to CalAmp as well?
It applies to all our parks, and only our parks at this time. They're the only company in the state that have parks with 200 or more spaces.
Correct. And so currently they have existing tenants that pay on this the utilities on the pro-rata basis.
Yes.
And so this bill, is, from what I understand, is essentially providing that new tenants into this park can also, or are they mandated to use the pro-rata system?
To also use the pro-rata system.
So they don't have to. There could be some other mechanism that CalAmp would accept?
If it's offered in that park.
Is it offered in that park?
I'm not sure in each park. I'd have to check with my client to clarify exactly, Mr. Chair, the basis on which they offer utility billing in each park.
Well, certainly it seems like a pretty straightforward thing. I have received several emails that do concern me about the increase in rates at CalAmp being pretty high. You know, I don't have anything but emails to rely on. I can't justify whether they're right or wrong, but some of the rate increases have been significant, to say the least, in this particular park. So that does cause me a little concern, but this particular bill seems to address something a little bit unrelated to that. And so I appreciate your testimony. Any other questions of Mr. Bowe? Thank you. I appreciate your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next up is Mr. Van Landingham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. John Van Landingham, Wayne County Legal Aid and Advocacy Center. I'm speaking on behalf of the Manufactured Housing Landlord-Tenant Coalition, which produced Senate Bill 772, which this bill hopes to amend one of the ramifications of 772. And I am here to report that the coalition discussed this issue at length at its meeting on January 19th. We do not have a bill in this special session. We are working hard to prepare for a bill in the 2011 session, and a lot of it will have to do with submetering of water, as well as a couple of other issues. We are neutral on this bill. We're neither for nor against. I would like to add that there are other parks besides CalAmp's parks that are affected by Senate Bill 929, which is the mandatory submetering at the end of 2012. That 929 applies to parks of 200 spaces or more. CalAmp is certainly one that's affected by that requirement, but there are the large parks in the state as well. I'd be glad to go through the background of this issue and how we got here and why we're here and why the coalition is neutral as opposed to being opposed. But in the interest of time, I'll let that be your call.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And are we speaking to an amendment in this bill?
I'm sorry. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for asking for that. The coalition's position is based entirely on the Dash 1 amendments, which Patrick was kind enough to help me ensure are exactly what the coalition agreed to. The coalition would not support the bill without the Dash 1 amendments.
So the coalition's in support of the Dash 1s, but neutral on the bill.
My job was to make sure, Mr. Chair, my job was to make sure that the Dash 1s reflect the coalition position on January 19th, which was to be neutral if the bill does a very small change, and that is allow existing parks that are all already pro rata billing to add new tenants with pro rata billing. If it's a new park, it cannot be pro rata. If it's an existing park with some tenants being billed other than pro rata, such as in the rent, and I believe CalAmp has such a park, new tenants cannot be billed pro rata. Senate Bill 772 has a bias, and one of the things it did was prohibit pro rata prospectively. We couldn't prohibit it retroactively because of constitutional reasons. So we were trying to prohibit going forward, but we didn't. I was the drafter. We didn't think about existing parks that are all already pro rata and a new tenant coming into that. So this bill fixes that oversight.
So, Mr. Van Landingham, are there any other parks that are, directly impacted by this bill that are operating with pro rata right now? Is that what I heard you say? There are others that are...
Mr. Chair, there are three ways that landlords recover for their water. In the rent, by pro rata, as Brian Bowe described, and submeter. We, in 2005, you all passed our bill that encourages park landlords to switch to submeters. Last session, you passed 929, which will require them to switch to submeters by the end of 2012. Are there other parks that are mixed? I don't know that. Most parks built in the 70s and 80s were built with water included in the rent because water was damned cheap in the 70s and 80s. Now it's not so cheap, and so landlords would like to get out of that cost. Tenants would like to have a fairer method of billing. One of the things that drove our bill in 2009, 772, was the concern that CalAmp was not fairly persuading tenants to agree to switch to pro rata. That's why 772 prohibits switching, even with tenant agreement. Does that help at all? I'm getting
some
into the detail.
Some. Representative Wisnett, question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sir, we all received a lot of emails from people upset with this. Was that before the Dash 1?
Chair Hovey, Representative Wisnett, I do not believe that they, well, I believe that their opposition is based largely on their concerns about CalAmp's practices, regardless of the merits of the bill, with or without the Dash 1. I don't believe the Dash 1 would resolve their concerns. And I'm speaking primarily of concerns raised by Peter Ferris and some residents of one of CalAmp's parks.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair. Follow-up. So there's a new member of this committee, so that, I'm assuming, then they're opposed to the bill, original bill.
Chair Hovey, Representative Wisnett, I believe they're opposed to the bill with the Dash 1s as well.
But I'm, Mr. Chair, okay. But I'm talking about 772.
Oh, excuse me. I don't quite know how to answer that. Were they opposed to 772? I don't believe that Mr. Ferris testified against 772 in 2009. It was in this committee, which saw a lot of us last session.
Thank you, Mr. Van Landingham. We were hoping your memory was better than ours. Because I don't remember either. So, any other discussion? I see no one else signed up. Is there anyone else that would wish to comment on this bill in the audience? Seeing nobody jumping up, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3694 and open a work session on House Bill 3694. I would entertain a motion on the amendment.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 3694.
Representative Tomei moves the adoption of the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 3694. Discussion? Seeing none, Cindy, would you call the roll, please?
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Matthews?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Representative Wisnett?
Aye.
Representative Winger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Dilliam?
Neutral.
Aye.
Good try.
Vice Chair Riley?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Aye. The Dash 1 amendment is adopted to House Bill 3694, and I will close the work session on House Bill 3694. Paperwork not being here to take further action.
Confirmed that he's in neutral.
So, what? Checking my agenda, checking it twice. With that, I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3615. And
glad you're here for that.
Patrick, would you give us a brief summary of the bill?
Sure, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3615 includes insurance and loans and extension of credit in definition of real estate, goods, and services for purposes of the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. The measure has an emergency clause and would take effect upon passage and signature. We have in your packets the Dash 1 amendment, which specifies that insurance, in the terms of the bill, does not cover public bodies, cities, counties, school districts, community college districts, community college service districts, or districts, to the extent that they are exempt from the insurance code under ORS 731.036.
Thank you. And I see Representative Call, the sponsor of the bill, is here, so if you'd like to come up. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for taking my testimony today, and thank you for hearing the bill.
And if you could identify yourself for the record, please.
Sure. I'm Representative Nick Call. I represent the communities of Fairview, Wood Village, Troutdale, and North Gresham, also known as House District 49. I'll try to be brief today. As you can see by the amount of people in the back of the room, this bill is first and foremost a jobs bill, Full Employment Act.
I get it.
That was a lot funnier to me.
Yes, we're aware.
Yeah. No, I don't see a lot of people laughing at this point.
So just basically what this bill does is it levels the playing field. In Oregon, we have a comprehensive consumer protection statute called the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. It has a list of behaviors that if businesses engage in them, the consumer has a private right of action, and if that behavior is outrageous enough, the Attorney General of Oregon has an opportunity to pursue an action in a court of law against those individuals who have committed that conduct. Most importantly is the misrepresentation of a product to a consumer. Oftentimes people talk about the Unlawful Trade Practices Act being created as a lemon law bill against car dealerships who would misrepresent the quality of their product to a consumer who would then get home and find that their car didn't function as it was presented to them. What this bill seeks to do is protect the consumer for misrepresentations made to them on the loan that covers the car and the insurance that covers the car too, which is to say that the bill seeks to make every business in the state of Oregon, no matter what the business is, no matter what the business does in the state of Oregon, liable the same way for their misrepresentations, and allow the consumers of Oregon to hold every business accountable in the state, no matter who they are, no matter what product they sell. There are a couple specific aspects of this bill that I'd like to note, just so you can understand some of the distortions that exist in the Unlawful Trade Practices Act as it pertains to lenders. The first big distortion is that mortgage brokers are actually covered under the Act. So if you're a mortgage broker and you sell someone a loan, a consumer can and misrepresent that product to a consumer, you can hail that mortgage broker into a court of law and hold them accountable. But if you walked into Chevy Chase or Bank of America and they gave you the same exact loan, the consumer would be precluded from filing action. And so already in the mortgage lending side of things, we have distortions in our law because of exclusions and exceptions like this. Another important characteristic is that because of principles of federalism and the supremacy of federal law, there are certain banking entities that we are unable to regulate in the state of Oregon. What that means, and I think rightfully so, is that the banking industry comes into our legislature often and says, don't regulate us here. Don't regulate our local banks more stringently than federal banks because we're going to create a disincentive for our local banks. They're chartered federally. You know, you will harm them if you regulate them more stringently than the federal government does. And if you're like me, you've been waiting for the federal government to actually figure out what to do around the banking crisis and waiting for them to come up with legislation that actually fixes this problem. Well, this bill is the only effective way for Oregonians and for the Attorney General of Oregon to hold the national banks accountable, the nationally chartered banks accountable. And that's because we can hold them accountable under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act while we cannot regulate them locally. And so there's yet another distortion in the conflict between federal law and state law around the practices of lending. And so with the mortgage brokers and the nationally chartered banks, we have all sorts of distortions that leave some consumers protected and other consumers not protected. And because of that, a simple change of a couple words in the Unlawful Trade Practices Act will help mitigate some of those damages and some of that distortion. Now, there has been rightful criticism of this bill, and I'll be the first one to admit that there has been some criticism about creating two parallel regulatory regimes in the AG's office and the Department of Consumer Business Services offices. I'm happy to say that I think that a deal has been reached that they will speak to later that gives DCBS exclusive control around crafting regulations that deal with the entities that they traditionally regulate. And so those industries that are traditionally regulated by DCBS will not see any new regulations thrust upon them, and they will not have to conform to a parallel regulatory regime. That said, the individual consumer will still have a private right of action against those banks and insurance companies that have harmed them and have injured them. And that said as well, the Attorney General will have exclusive enforcement of the Unlawful Trade Practices Act against those entities that aren't regulated by DCBS, which means credit card companies and large national and multinational banks that harm Oregon consumers, groups of people, entities that are beyond the reach of Oregon law right now. Just a couple very minor, small, final points to finish why this bill is, I think, very prescient and very important right now. The first one is that I think I've addressed the concern about parallel regulatory regimes and the fact that I'm receptive to the banking insurance community's criticisms of that and think that we've reached a solution there. Where I'm not equally satisfied is with the contention that regulation is the only or even most adequate remedy for a harmed consumer. 35 years ago when the UTPA was created, the banking and insurance industries were much more heavily regulated at the federal level. This isn't a partisan issue. There's been Democrats in the White House, Republicans in the White House, Democrats in charge of the federal Congress and Senate, and Republicans in charge of the federal Congress and Senate. And yet no matter who became in charge, regulations were torn down, laws were changed. I think most importantly to our current situation was the Clinton administration's change, pulling down the firewall between insurance companies and banking at the banking industry, such that it's almost impossible now to disaggregate the conduct of a bank from the conduct of an insurance company. Now, because regulation has been systematically undermined, and because no regulation is forthcoming, there is very little that we can do to try to protect the Oregon consumer. Very little, except for remove the longstanding exemption of banks and insurance companies from the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. But the final thing I want to say is that this doesn't protect every consumer. There are consumers, and this is, goes very much to this concept of personal responsibility for the homeowner. This doesn't protect the sophisticated consumer. This doesn't protect the consumer who entered the marketplace and bought one house and flipped it, bought a second house and flipped it, bought a third house and flipped it, and used really bad judgment and got involved with debt instruments that they should have known better than to get involved with. But what this act does protect is it protects the consumer who couldn't have known better. The consumer that's sitting there looking at a Prolix insurance contract or mortgage document that they couldn't possibly understand. And listen, I'm about to be a lawyer, and I can tell you that I don't... Thank you, Jeff. Fingers crossed. That lots of lawyers I've talked to about this will tell you very frankly that they've never read their insurance contract, never read their mortgage contract. Lots of lawyers who work in this kind of area trying to protect consumers will say that the first time they ever looked at a mortgage, they were stymied by the complexity of the language that was there. Right? And so what we're looking to do is to protect the consumer who couldn't know better. The consumer that is trapped trying to articulate the question that they don't know they're supposed to ask. And that's what the UTPA does, is it says that at some point, the business has to be more forthcoming. The business has to be more straightforward with the consumer. Because at the end of the day, what we're talking about here oftentimes, especially around banks and insurance, is the average consumer's access to the American dream. And when we're talking about something as important as that, I think that it's not unreasonable to expect that every business in the state of Oregon should have to play by the same rules. And every business, no matter how powerful, no matter how many lobbyists they have in the room, should be held accountable when they misrepresent a product to a consumer. And with that, I'll conclude my remarks. I'm happy to take questions.
Representative Krieger.
Representative Collins, did you talk this briefly at your state bar exam?
This is the briefest I've ever been in my life.
And wasn't it?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, good day. You said it should apply to everyone, I think, except the bill doesn't cover cities, counties, school districts, community college districts, community colleges. So it's not everyone.
Yeah, what I'll say to that, and one of the reasons I was willing to actually accept an amendment on that front is that when you're talking about benefits provided by a local government, the citizen, the employee of the state or local government has significantly greater remedies with regards to denials of their benefits that might otherwise, or misrepresentations about what their benefits might be, than the average consumer in the marketplace does. I mean, heck, you know, the right to have a state job is protected by the Due Process Clause of the Constitution of the United States and affords you certain rights to a hearing either before termination or after termination, and most employees don't have that. And so when we're talking about state-provided benefits to state employees, there are adequate remedies and procedural safeguards to ensure the consumer in that context is protected. And if those safeguards existed in the regular marketplace for the average consumer, I wouldn't be pushing this bill today.
Thank you, Representative Call. I appreciate your testimony bringing this issue forward. And we need to move on with some more testimony. We've got a large amount of testimony. I'm hoping to hear from it. So If we aren't going to work this bill today, committee, so if you have questions that you really need to have answered at this hearing, please make sure you ask them. But we'll also have another opportunity to discuss this bill, I'm sure. So with that, I'd like to call up Angela Martin and Renee Maxwell and Randy Daigle. I don't know if I'm pronouncing those names correctly, but... Okie dokie. Randy Daigle, are you here? Maybe we can skip to John Bartholomew.
Gets for speaking up.
Maybe you were hoping on coming up last, but no such luck. Go ahead and introduce yourself for the record, please.
Thank you. My name is Randy Daigle. I own Lentz Body Shop in Portland, Oregon. Representative Foley and members of the committee, this is an old problem. This is nothing new. And I heard Representative Call talk about the banking side of it. I'm here because of the problems between the automobile insurance companies and the consumer and the body shops. You'll see by my written testimony there, I am stunned that not everybody's held to the same playing field here as it comes to Unfair Claims Practices Act and some of the issues that are going on. I've had so many consumers in my office complain that they're just stymied. When they file an insurance commissioner complaint, I myself have gotten letters back from Ron Fredrickson, the consumer manager there, that has told me, don't file a complaint. There's nothing I'm going to do. You know, if you look at the white paper here, this is just a snippet of the Oregon Revised Statutes, and those laws are on the books, but nobody will enforce them. You'll see the top here that says, hi, Jeff, I forward this to Safeco Insurance because they're asking me to put an uncertified part on an automobile. It's a bumper reinforcement. It affects the safety of that automobile. It affects the triggering of your airbags. A number of years ago, no insurance company would ever put an aftermarket part. An aftermarket part is something that's not made by the original manufacturer. It's made in Hong Kong or Taiwan or offshore. There was legislation passed here that these parts must be certified. We now have some insurance companies that I've had a Safeco supervisor laugh at me and say, this way, we own the insurance commissioner's office. They're not going to do anything against us. I was stunned. But you'll see here that I got a response from the Safeco adjuster, and I highlighted just where he says, hey, it's an aftermarket crash part. It's not visible on the exterior of the car, so I'm going to use it. So here's what he does to me. If I put that part on this car, it renders it unsafe. If that car gets in another accident and the airbags don't go off, I get sued. And the consumer could die. He could get hurt. So I have a choice here. The consumer now, this is not his insurance company. It's the other guy's fault, the other guy's insurance. They sold a policy that states that they will take care of all these costs, and yet when it comes forth, they use every issue that they can to not pay for it. And even here, just this little example, that it's supposed to be a exterior part, and yet, not to get down to the critical, but it does also state an inner and outer panel. They use whatever they can to skirt all these Oregon laws, these statutes. So it's frustrating being in business because where does that leave the consumer? Where does it leave the collision industry? A lot of insurance companies will not use these parts whatsoever. The biggest insurance company in the United States, State Farm, will not use them. I don't believe Oregon Mutual will use them. Liberty Mutual will not use them. Good stand-up insurance companies recognize there's problems with these parts and won't use them. And then you have some other companies that are forcing the usage of them, whether they're certified or not. If they're certified, they're supposed to undergo the same crash testing that the manufacturers do. These don't. So what we have here is the consumer is stuck. He gets whatever is offered to him, and it may put his life in danger, and most of them don't even know. So we've got laws that are just not being enforced. We have an easy fix here. I believe that insurance is no different than anybody else. They should follow the same laws that you and I do, that I have followed in my business, that every other business follows. My daughter recently had an accident, and it was with Nationwide Insurance. They attempted to do the same thing. And had I not been in the industry, had I not known what type of parts these were, some unscrupulous shop would have put them on there, and if my daughter got in another car accident, she could die from it. So this is really important. This piece of legislation, or this correction, has been a problem for a long time. It's nothing new. Please address it. Please correct it so that everybody's the same. Everybody's fair. It's not that it's going to cost an arm and a leg with the insurance industry. I mean, they're making money. They've got to make money. They've got obligations to you and I and everybody else, too. But it's become a situation where I've seen in the last several years, it's no longer about quality. It's no longer about safety. It's about a dollar. And that's what it boils down to. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Degg. I'm just curious. Have you ever brought this issue to the attention of the insurance division?
Yes, I personally have. I was told to don't go away, don't bother me anymore. I mean, I have letters to that effect. We don't accept complaints from collision shops. And I'm going, wait a minute, this is the Division of Consumer and Business Affairs. I'm a consumer, and I own a business. And I was just blown off. I'm the secretary of the Oregon Collision Repairs Association in the state, and I can tell you dozens and dozens of our members have just given up hope. And a lot of them aren't. Where are they today? You know, they're in their shops trying to eke out a living. It's tough. It's hard. Economic times are difficult. They're scared. They're terrified. The propaganda that's put out there is that we're trying to hold rates down. It's like a USAA adjuster told me this morning. Last year was the best year in the history of our company, even with today's economic times. And that's great for them. I mean, they've got responsibilities they need to take care of. But when you have an unfair playing field where they're doing whatever they want and they're flaunting all these laws, and it's like I told one adjuster, you're spitting in my face. You won't follow the laws. And they laugh at us. And they say, we don't have to. They're not going to do anything against us. Well, I'm asking you to make the playing field level so that at least the insurance commissioner's office can do something, so the attorney general's office can do something, so that at least there's adequate and it's even with everybody. Right now it's not.
And thank you.
It's scary. Thank you.
Appreciate it. Mr. Bartholomew.
Thank you, Representative Holvey, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Bartholomew. I'm with the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group, OSPIRG. I'd like to testify in support of HB 3615 that will close the loophole that exempts lenders and insurance companies from the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. I am going to focus on the lenders, since this is the area that we deal more with than anything else. We work a lot on the foreclosure crisis, trying to help people stay in their homes as well as, stabilize the entire economy through making the mortgage lending system stabilized. And this crisis we're currently finding ourselves in has its roots in questionable lending practices, primarily by national lenders, not so much the state chartered banks. But this foreclosure crisis has impacted entire communities, bringing property values down. Individual families have lost their homes and their stability, and as I said, it led to the instability of the entire American and global economies. And currently, the lenders responsible for this crisis are unaccountable to Oregonians. While other states like Arizona and Iowa are considering lawsuits against lenders to hold them responsible for their role in creating this foreclosure crisis, Oregon has to sit back and watch. I have personally spoken to homeowners who have been told different things by their lenders from what it actually turned out to be. For example, I spoke to a woman who believed she had a 30-year fixed rate mortgage. But then after 5 years, all of a sudden the payments jumped up and the interest rate jumped up. And found out on one page there was this little line that said ARM in parentheses, and that was the only thing she was told by her lender in verbally that this was a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage, and it wasn't. They trusted their lender, and if that trust is broken, there should be a way for the consumer to be able to have some recourse and for the Department of Justice to protect the public. Now, this bill would not punish businesses that are actually operating on the up-and-up. It only impacts those who are operating in deceptive and predatory practices. I see no reason why businesses doing that should be protected. It puts businesses who are operating ethically at a disadvantage. This legislation is simple. It just says that lenders are insurers are held to the same standards as carpenters, farmers, daycare operators, foresters, and public relations consultants. So Osberg urges this committee to vote in support of HB 3615. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Tomei,
could I ask a brief question of Mr. Daigle?
Certainly.
Thank you. Mr. Daigle, you gave us this pack of information, right?
Yes.
So it sounds like the state law says that aftermarket items can be used if they have gone through, if they're the same quality and if they've been through some kind of test that seems to...
Correct. That would be CAPA, Certified Auto Parts Association.
So are you saying that these aftermarket items that are put in automobiles that you're repairing, that they have not gone through that
This particular process? One that Safeco's demanding that we install has not been certified.
And so that is definitely against the law,
absolutely,
right?
It will put these people's lives at risk.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony very much. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next up, could I have John Powell and Steve Merle? How many years will it take me to make sure I get that right? And Mike Dewey. I'm throwing you into this mix.
Chair Holby, members of the committee, my name is John C. Powell. With me today is Steve Merle, claims attorney with State Farm, who will be willing to answer any questions you may have after my testimony, thankfully. I'm an attorney here in Salem and an associate with John Powell and Associates, and today I speak on behalf of Liberty Mutual and State Farm Insurance Companies. I handed you out a binder going through a list of things I'm going to go through today to really show why insurance products are different from other products we all purchase on a day-to-day basis. When a consumer purchases a product in general commerce, say you go to Best Buy to purchase an electronic item or to your appliance store to purchase a washer and dryer, you expect fairness. You expect fairness from the manufacturer, fairness from the retailer, to believe what you're told and that those expectations will be met. And that is what the Unlawful Trade Practices Act was designed to protect consumers. On the other hand, when a consumer goes to purchase a insurance product, the issues of fairness have already been dealt with. The Oregon Insurance Division must first approve the actual wording of each insurance policy sold before it's marketed or sold to the consumer. And if you flip over to tab one of my handout, this is just in there to show you, this is the standards for auto insurance, and it's a checklist that the insurer and the insurance division must go through and check off that each policy that an insurer is proposing to take to market must meet all of these standards. As you can see, it's pretty in-depth. It lists each statute that corresponds to each column. And then after the sale of an insurance product, the insurance division continues to protect the consumer. whether it's an insurance policy per se or insurance companies or insurance agents, they're all subject to an entire section of Oregon law known as the insurance code, which is over 500 pages. And within that code, it includes a section entitled the Unfair Claims Settlement Practices Act. And this act gives consumers protections against misrepresentations, delay in processing claims fairly, and failure of insurers to respond promptly to communications related to such claims, among many more protections. If you'll flip to page 2, I've printed that out for you, and it lists each protection in the insurance code under that act. And then under the third tab is a section of law, ORS 746-240. What this section does is gives consumers even more protection, and the director of DCBS real teeth in insurance-only issues. And it states, and I quote, "No person shall engage in this state in any trade practice that, although not expressly defined and prohibited in the insurance code, is found by the director of DCBS to be an unfair or deceptive act or practice in the transaction of insurance that is injurious to the insurance buying public." So what this says is the director of DCBS has the authority to go after an insurance agent or an insurance company, even if what they do is not prohibited by law, just as long as the director of DCBS finds that what they're doing is unfair. They can go after them just as though it was against the law in statute. In addition to the insurance code, the insurance division has vast rulemaking powers, and included in the packet under tab 4 is just the table of contents of the division's rules. It's over 26 pages long, and it's in that's pretty small font as well.
So, Mr. Powell, I usually try to be fair to everybody in my committee, but could you sort of summarize it? I fear that you're going to walk us through every tab as slow. And since we have the book, we'll be able to really get into that. I have a tremendous amount of people and time left on my agenda is starting to dwindle.
Definitely.
So if you could summarize a little bit, I would appreciate it.
Okay.
I give you a lot more leeway than I would your father.
Thank you. Just to summarize, the insurance code also gives DCBS the authority to issue fines, issue cease and desist orders, revoke agents' licenses, as well as tell an insurance company they cannot do business in Oregon. And the last thing, just to summarize, the thing that makes insurance products different from other consumer products is that there is a large section of Oregon law. Probably insurance is most likely the most regulated of any industry. And there's regulation that affects it before the item is taken to market and afterwards. And it has an agency that understands the specifics and the technicalities of insurance that has the regulatory teeth and expertise to deal with it. And just to wrap up, sorry to refer to one more tab, but the tab 6 is a testimony from now Governor Ted Kulongoski when he was the director of the Department of Insurance and Finance, which is now DCBS. And it dealt with creating a private cause of action under the insurance code. And while this proposal he was testifying against is different from the one today, the issue is exactly the same. And as you can see, he said that if parties to a dispute know it is going to court, they will respond to a regulatory agency differently, and the parties to such disputes will use the regulatory agency as a research arm in court instead of resolving the issue equitably. Sorry I took so long. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for your time.
Thank you. Mr. Merle.
Chair Hovey, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Steve Merle with State Farm Insurance Companies, and keeping with the chair's admonition, I will be very brief. I think one important issue to make sure the committee understands is unlike some of the other industries talked about here today, the property and casualty industry remains a state-based regulatory industry. We're regulated by each state separately for the business we do in that state. Oregon has absolute control and say over what we're doing here as far as property and casualty matters. Other than that, I'm here and available for any questions you may have, should you have some.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Mike Dewey, representing ODS Health Plans. ODS is licensed to do business in the state of Oregon. We oppose House Bill 3615. I was a little bit confused about the proponent's view in terms of the jurisdiction that DCBS would have in DOJ. I wasn't clear if there were going to be amendments that would define that in the sense that this bill is a private right of action, which expands the opportunities for an individual that believes they've been aggrieved. I do want to thank Mr. Powell because he's provided a litany of the examples of regulations on one side of the ledger, but it's appropriate to say they are significant for the health insurance industry. It is very, very regulated. We have prompt pay statutes. We have external review when needed. We think this is going to be cumbersome. I'm not going to say that it may add costs when we're trying to find ways to lower costs, but I do not think this is in the best interest of Oregon at this point in time. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Representative Riley, a quick question.
Very quick. I just want to point out to Mr. Powell that we just overrode a veto of the governor. So.
Representative Gilliam, Mr. Chair, quick question?
Certainly. One of you, Mr. Chair, if you would. We have one set of amendments, dash one, in front of us for this bill that we're not moving today. Is that correct?
Patrick, can you answer that question? I am not sure how many amendments the committee actually has in its possession, but we are not moving the bill today, nor are we moving any amendments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The dash one amendment, which is included in your packet, was submitted by Representative Call's staff. That is the amendment that we have before us.
Thank you.
Then my question is to this panel very quickly, if I could, Mr. Chair.
That's two questions. You already asked one.
That's a good point.
Go ahead. You'll be your last, though.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Call mentioned in his testimony that he had worked out a deal. I think those are his words. And I assume that's what dash ones are. I just want to know if the three of you were involved in the deal making.
In looking at the dash ones, that amendment just exempted, it looked like, public bodies. And I'm not familiar with what he was referring to there, if something has been worked out with DCBS or not.
Chair Holvey and Representative Gilliam, likewise, I was not part of anything that he was talking about.
And to be fair, there are an awful lot of people that and entities that are involved in this bill, so it'd be very difficult for the representative to contact everyone, albeit we haven't seen the other discussion vehicle, if there is one, in terms of who would be defined as the entity that would use their regulatory authorities or prosecution authorities.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony today.
Thank you.
Sure. Very good.
Do we have any more testimony on this bill?
We have 11 more people to testify on this bill in 20 minutes. So next up I have Richard Kingsley, Gayla Cheek, and Edward Davis. And if you're providing us written testimony, I would appreciate you not reading it to us, but just to summarize what you may say, because I'm going to have to put people on about two and a half minutes apiece.
Okay, Mr.
And
Chair.
And I will stop you at that point, unfortunately. It may seem rude, but...
I understand.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, I am Richard Kingsley from Kamak Kingsley Insurance and State in Oregon. I am a past president and the incoming chair for the Government Relations Committee for the Professional Insurance Agents Association of Oregon and Idaho, also called the PIA. There are five associations, agent associations in Oregon, and all of them are opposed to this bill as written. There's two of us here to testify. The other two would like their names on the record, the Oregon Health Underwriters, the Surplus Lines Association of Oregon, and the Life Underwriters of Oregon. Excuse me.
PIA is a statewide group of independent insurance agents, and most of the agents are small business people like myself. We're strongly opposed to House Bill 3615 as written. You've heard from the insurance companies on what they think it will do. The insurance division can and does fine insurance companies and agents for any misrepresentation. The Unlawful Trade Practices Act is not an appropriate vehicle for regulating insurance transactions. The insurance division does have adequate protection for the public. And just to let you know where Oregon sits in the nation, according to a 2009 Insurance Information Institute report, Oregon is the 27th lowest premium in the United States. And their division just released a record that last week, I believe, that says we have one of the lowest premiums in the United States for homeowners insurance. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it. If you'd identify yourself for the record, please.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Gayla Cheek. I live in Gresham, and I work for a small independent agency, Chet Hill Insurance, in Portland. I represent a large part of the industry in the state. I work directly with people and businesses every day to help them with their insurance needs. We do not need any more laws when we already have effective ones in force. Already, the Oregon Insurance Division can fine and revoke a company's or producer's license. I have found that they are personally very quick to act on any consumer complaint. And when a consumer complains, they do respond to them. We have current laws that give the Oregon Insurance Division authority for comprehensive regulation. We do not need any other regulator on trade practices. Already our insureds are protected under insurance contracts and in the event that the insurance company does not comply with its obligations. Laws are already in place. They are effective. The current system is working. It doesn't need to be fixed. I have been in the insurance industry for 36 years. I'm a producer, and I help people. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ed Davis. I'm here representing the Independent Insurance Agents of Oregon. I'm the legislative chair for the association. I have been in the insurance business since 1965, 9 years as an actuary with Standard Life Insurance Company in Portland, and for the last, since 1974, as an independent insurance agent representing consumers throughout Oregon. I'd like to point out to you that we as insurance agents, our independent interests are to have you do things that would cause our premiums or our customers to go up, because we are compensated on a percentage basis. So the more you do to raise premiums, the better off personally we are. So our testimony in this case is for the benefit of our customers and actually contrary to our own self-interest. The Representative Call has been quoted as saying the insurance industry gets a free pass while ripping off consumers. And I think that's far from the truth. While you might find individual cases where there have been misunderstandings and things that have not been done properly, in my experience, the insurance division has done a wonderful job and is seen as a model throughout the country for balanced and fair regulation to keep insurance companies interested in doing business for our Oregon consumers and to also protect the interest of consumers in the process. Our peers in New York, which has been touted as a model for this type of joint regulation, report to us significant confusion in terms of how this is supposed to work. And while Representative Call suggests that an agreement has been reached with the insurance division, what he described sounded to me like simply taking the insurance industry out of this bill and letting the DCBS and the insurance division continue to regulate it as they do currently. I'd like to add just a couple of more comments. Regardless of your position on the recent tax measures, I think everyone would agree that it has tended to reinforce the perception, rightly or wrongly, that Oregon is an unfriendly place to do business. And this legislation, in my opinion, would simply tend to support that that perception. Rightly or wrongly, our court system is already stuck with budgetary constraints in terms of trying to deal reasonably and timely with the existing burden of litigation that they have to face, and adding an additional private right of action to a system that already is adequately, in my opinion, regulated simply would add an additional and unnecessary burden to the court system. And finally, increased litigation always leads to increased costs, leads to higher premiums for our customers, and higher commissions for us, as I've said. The last comment is directly related to some of the comments that I've made in the testimony earlier. First, I'd like to remind you that under Oregon law, no insurance company has the legal right to dictate to their policyholder how and when the repairs to their vehicles are going to be done. The only thing the law gives them is the right to determine whether that is a covered loss and what is a reasonable amount for them to pay for that loss. So if the complaint, if an insured of Safeco, for example, doesn't like what Safeco is offering, that insured has the right to file the complaint, not the body shop. The body shop isn't the consumer for that particular transaction. The client is. And I have reminded my clients of that on more than one occasion. So
thank you for that. Can you wrap it up in about 10 seconds?
I'm done. Thank you, Mr.
Great,
Chair.
Great. I appreciate your testimony. I appreciate you coming forward with your position on the bill. Thank you. Next up is Angela Martin and Renee Maxwell.
Chair Holvey, Renee Maxwell is going to testify first. Hello. I'm Renee Maxwell from Portland. I ran into financial difficulties following my dad's passing in December of 2007. Funeral costs put on my American Express card sent me over the limit, and due to my state of mind, after my father's passing that month, I lost track of time and didn't make a payment that month. And due to my savings account being wiped out, I was unable to keep up the minimum payments. I tried several arrangements to pay off the balance, but the only viable option was to make a payment arrangement with American Express. Some people ask me why I didn't just file for bankruptcy. I didn't want the mark on my credit, and I really do want to pay what I owe. But I also deserve fair treatment from American Express. American Express was very aggressive with the collection calls, and I had to repeat the story of my father's passing daily to them. This went on for months. It was a very difficult period for me, but every time they called, I assured them I'd pay. This is my debt, and I intend to honor it. Eventually, it got so there was no way to get ahead. I agreed to a payment plan, which I honored, and they increased my rate from 17% to 28%, kept impounding interest, and kept charging me monthly $38 late fees and $35 over-limit fees. At this rate, there would be no way to get under the limit and make any headway, which is their whole point. I am their meat and potatoes. At this point, the account was closed, and I stuck to an agreed-upon payment plan. American Express continued to charge me interest I did not owe. What does it matter if the charges are illegal if there is no way for me to have the law enforced? In 2008, I charged $354 to my American Express card. I was charged $552 in fees and $3,800 in interest in 1 year. And my opening balance in 2008 was $20,000. Today, my balance is $21,000, and I'm still making monthly payments on time. My card was canceled in May of 2008. And I'd like to be reimbursed for the compounded charges and the time dealt with it and all the harassing phone calls. And it was really hard with the phone calls because they called me all hours of the day and night and weekend and screamed at and told what a horrible person I was and that I would never get out of debt with them. One of their collection agents actually told me that if Amex is doing this, then it's not illegal. So, thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Angela Martin with Our Oregon. Renee, who actually prefers to go by Max, is someone that contacted us over 2 years ago when we were asking for examples of people who'd struggled to right a wrong with a credit card company. I hope in her testimony it came through that she's not asking for a reversal of the $20,000 debt. Her claim has always been against the $2,000 debt that was illegally charged to her account. And because of limitations of taking this case to court, getting that $2,000 removed has been a two-year battle for Max. Enforceable protections for consumers is critical, whether the wrongdoer is a person, an appliance dealer, a bank, or an insurance company. In most states, that enforceable protection is offered through the state UTPA. The question before you today is whether the general consumer protection law in Oregon should also apply to business transactions that involve credit and insurance. I'm sure we've heard that every day thousands of honest and profitable businesses abide by the UTPA. I would argue that thousands of honest and profitable insurance, community banks, credit unions also abide by the general principles of do not defraud your customers, promote fairness and honesty in the marketplace. However, it is the outliers that are costing consumers literally thousands of dollars that this law is intended to protect. Again, every state has a consumer protection statute prohibiting unfair and deceptive trade practices. And most states include a consumer loan transactions in that consumer loan statute, consumer protection statute. In the packet I handed out, I included a list of states, 27 of which do cover credit transactions in their UTPA. Prior to passage of UTPA laws in the 60s and the 70s, consumers and state agencies had few tools to guard against abusive business practices. Existing remedies, such as common law fraud, were deemed insufficient to protect consumers in an increasingly sophisticated marketplace. One of the reasons common law fraud was deemed insufficient is the inability for consumers to have their legal fees covered when they bring a suit in good faith. An individual's ability to have the cost of their legal representation covered when they prevail against that wrongdoer is really an indispensable part of consumer protection. Again, I point to the example of Max. If you can't afford to take your case before a judge, you have no case whatsoever. Opponents of this bill have loudly proclaimed that the industries they represent are highly regulated. However, this bill is not about adding more rules. It's about adding accountability and enforcement to fair rules of fair play. Certainly from the perspective of a consumer who has no recourse to seek a remedy against a lender who has misled them about the terms of their loan or added fees and interest that were not earned, regulation without enforcement protection.
Angela, if you could wrap it up really quick, that'd be great.
Is simply not adequate for them. In my written testimony, I provide some additional examples of where states are taking action to help address some of the continued concerns that we have with homeowners seeking loan modifications. I'll certainly allow you to review that and end my testimony there.
Thank you.
I know it's been a long day of testimony.
I appreciate that. Plus, I appreciate you not reading us verbatim your testimony and pointing out some of the pieces in it. And certainly appreciate the information. Not seeing any questions. So next up, I'd like to have Paul Cosgrove and Tim Martinez and Melissa Briggs, I think.
Mr. Chair, I just want to make a statement that I think it's we see lobbyists up here a lot, and we see people who are trained to come and testify before us, and I think it's great that a citizen will come all the way here to testify, and I appreciate that, Max. I'm not sure that you heard me. Thank you for coming.
Good afternoon. If you could identify yourself for the record and get people on about a two-minute time frame.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association. Whatever time I don't use, I will give to my counsel, Melissa Briggs, here with us, and whatever she doesn't use, she'll give to Paul to wrap up.
I'll keep track of that.
I'll be brief. The association asked their outside counsel, Melissa Briggs and Ken Sherman, to take a look in both the federal and state statute and to identify the areas where there are consumer protection statutes. After about 3 hours, we told them to stop looking because it was running into some real money at that point. And this is, frankly, just a partial list. The one side is all the federal statutes and regulations. Everything here has a consumer protection component to it, has some consumer protections in it, both at the federal and then the other side on the state side. And I will say this is just for financial institutions, and there would be probably some different sites if actually had credit unions in here. And also, just so you know, the United Financial Lobby, which includes credit unions, mortgage brokers, mortgage bankers, is opposed to this legislation. So, you know, we'd be happy if any member, after they look at this list, has some specific questions that we could answer for them outside of the hearing. We'd be happy to do that, point out and show exactly what kind of remedies folks have. But in many instances in here, you're talking civil penalties, you're talking private right of action, and in some cases you're even talking criminal penalties. So with that, I'll yield whatever time I have left to our lawyer.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee. Melissa Briggs, General Counsel for the Oregon Bankers Association. As Tim said, this list that we have is just what we could come together with in a few hours. It doesn't include everything, but we do believe that there's extensive federal and state regulation of banks and other financial institutions. So putting that aside, one thing I just wanted to point out was in the UTPA, something that really concerns us is the unconscionable tactics provision. And what that is it permits a customer to enter an unconscionable tactic is defined as including, but not being limited to, permitting a customer to enter into a transaction with knowledge that there is no reasonable probability of payment of the attendant financial obligation in full by the customer when due. So, putting that into play for a lending institution, 2020 hindsight, if any court can come in and say, you know what, you probably shouldn't have made that loan, that was an unconscionable tactic, or you probably shouldn't have applied that collection practice, unconscionable tactic, then combine that with the fact that if a bank is sued under the UTPA, attorney fees are not allowed to recover for the bank, even if they win, unless the consumer was found to have brought the action unjustly, which is pretty unlikely that's going to happen. So put those all together, and in that instance, we feel that banks are not going to take that risk. And in this environment, we want banks to be lending, extending credit, and it's just not going to happen if that risk is there, on top of all the other regulations and risks the banks have. I think that's all I have for now. I'll turn it over to Paul.
Mr. Chairman, Paul Cosgrove, representing the Oregon Financial Service Association, members of the committee. I'll just point out that the reason I think this list of federal regulations and state regulations is important is that, in fact, consumers do have remedies. And that's the basis why 30 years ago, when the UTPA was adopted, that financial institutions and insurance was excluded from the UTPA is because of the extensive body of state and federal regulation of those industries. The UTPA was initially adopted in order to be sort of a catch-all for folks who weren't heavily regulated, like banks and insurance companies. Is that regulation perfect? Of course not. But there are aggressive restrictions and requirements on us in those federal and state laws. Many of those have private rights of action, and all of them that have private rights of action allow for recovery of attorney's fees, so that a consumer who has a problem with one of our institutions not accurately or fully or fairly disclosing the terms of a loan or any of the other things involved in the lending transaction does have a remedy and can get a lawyer and pursue it. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. I appreciate the succinctness of your testimony and the information that you provided us. Any questions? Appreciate your testimony. Next up, I have Phil Goldsmith and Scott Winkles. Good afternoon. If you'd identify yourself for the record and try to keep your testimony to 2 minutes, I'd appreciate it.
Thank you, Chair Holvey and members of the committee. I'm Phil Goldsmith. I'm a lawyer in private practice in Portland, Oregon. A large portion of my practice is involves the representation of borrowers in mortgage-related issues. I have a lot of specific testimony that I won't summarize even, but I am basically here in rebuttal to what the last panel said, since I actually represent clients. There are cases where there are remedies. There specifically are remedies under what used to be Chapter 59, which is now Chapter 86A, that regulates mortgage brokers and mortgage bankers. That statute does not apply to regulated financial institutions such as national banks and federal savings banks, among others. Representative Call asked me to look at federal preemption issues, and it's clear that the way to plug that gap, consistent with federal law as it stands now, is to expand the statute looks like the UTPA, which prohibits misrepresentations, rather than to expand the reach of the specific mortgage-related statute. That likely would result in a holding of federal preemption. But as my written testimony indicates, right now, whether somebody is protected or not by in a situation where they're induced by misrepresentations into getting into an unfavorable loan on terms that they have no knowledge about and never would have entered into if they had known, that depends on who they borrowed from. And there are gaps in existing Oregon law. My client, Rita Laux, she and her husband I represented successfully because their claims in part were against a mortgage broker, wanted to be here today but was not able to get off of her job working as a mixer at Nabisco. And speaking in part for her. I know that there are questions about why there should be legislation now, and I think the answer to that is you don't have a time machine. You can't go back and fix all those wrongs that have already occurred when people were lied to and deceived and ended in bad loans and don't have remedies. But the problems continue on today in different forms. I have been talking with folks in St. Helens who got an FHA loan. Their FHA lender didn't pay off the prior mortgages on their property, and now they're, you know, caught between two sets of lenders demanding money from them because of the misrepresentations that were made in their loan. And so even though things are supposed to be better, they're still not for everybody, and this is a significant problem that can be fixed in an easy way as to financial institutions by the passage of 3615, which I encourage.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Scott Winkles representing the League of Oregon Cities. My comments are specific to the -1 amendments of the legislation, which would exempt out your public self-insured bodies. Whatever reasons there might be to bring in insurance into the definition of the UTP, the League would respectfully submit they wouldn't necessarily apply to the practices of the self-insured bodies, and here's why. There's no history, nor is there any conceivable motivation for a public self-insured entity to engage in any of the practices the UTP is designed to prevent. Public insured bodies, we don't really market the product except internally. These are there's no real collection practice. There's no history of us engaging in these sorts of activities. However, the provisions of the UTP would allow a potential competitor or a disgruntled former employee or some other disgruntled party access to the remedies in 646 of the Oregon Revised Statute, which involve mandatory investigations, injunctions, and civil penalties. Which would require the public body to expend a lot of time and potentially money to address these, even though, again, these are public bodies who are currently exempted from the insurance code and, again, have no history or motivation to engage in any of the practices that are listed in the UTP.
Thank you. I appreciate both your testimonies today.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Winger.
Quick question?
Question.
Sir, was it your... I want to make sure I heard this right. Was the concern that people might use this statute and create nuisances that might add costs to what you're doing, which would then be passed on to the people you're trying to provide a benefit to? Did I hear that right?
Representative Holby, Chair Holby, Representative Wingard, the point I was making is that subjecting the public bodies to what we would what conceivably recall referred to as harassment or other nuisance wouldn't necessarily be in the public interest for a public body. There's no way for the public body to recover costs. Our costs are limited. And again, we aren't, public bodies don't engage in these activities and have never engaged in the activities, and nor is there a motivation to engage in these activities that are regulated behaviors under the UTP.
I would respectfully submit that your source of revenue is the same as a private business.
Thank you, Representative Matthews.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just real quick. So, Mr. Winkle, thanks for your testimony. So are you suggesting that an employee, like a current employee, may perhaps have a private right of action with this towards, say, an entity that if there was unilateral change throughout the contract, a change in insurance that was something subjected to bargaining but didn't occur, there could be private right of action? Is that a concern of yours?
Representative Holby, Chair Holby, Representative Matthews, the employee that you described would have a remedy under the Employment Relations Board, and there is a considerable body of case law in front of the ERB where there have been disputes as to what's happened in a contract, and that employee could address it that way.
No, I'm and aware of it. Mr. Chair, follow up. I'm aware of that, very aware of that, but is it also potentially that there could be more to gain through the private right of action? Perhaps as another remedy?
Chair Holby, Representative Matthews, because the activity is regulated in the UTP, I'm not as sure what it is the city could have done to bring itself into the UTP, and whether that, and again, the employee you described has a much more efficient means of resolving the dispute.
But that wouldn't include any personal gain for any hardships along the way through the ERB, necessarily. Mr. Chair, one last follow-up, please, from Mr. Goldsmith. I want to make this clear, and I really do appreciate your time, and thanks for your testimony. But in this case, where you apparently defended these folks, or you took their case for them,
yes,
represented them, this actually, in their case, turned out favorable, where the actual laws applied and... I should say the statute worked, but you're saying there's still holes that are available, remedies that may not have worked for anybody else, but they just happen to work out for you. Is that correct?
Chair Holby, Representative Matthews, that's correct. Those clients fit within what existing law provides, and my point is that that law does not and may not, and it maybe cannot, cover national banks and federal savings banks and such like.
Okay, thank you, sir.
Thank you for your testimony. I really appreciate you coming forward. I got a couple more testifiers last. I have Corey Streisinger and Keith Dabanovich. I'm assuming they're coming up together because they were on the same space.
They're coming up together because you called them together.
Although, if you wish to come up separately,
no,
that's...
We wish to come up together.
Happy to come up.
Good afternoon, and I'm sure you've been listening intently back there of the testimony before us, so I appreciate you taking your time and studying this very important issue. So if you'd identify yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Corey Streisinger, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and I apologize for my voice. I have been suffering from the types of things people suffer from this type of time of year, so hope it doesn't give out on me. Appreciate the opportunity to be here today to talk about House Bill 3615, which, of course, would include insurance and lending. In the UTPA, we regulate insurance and lending, some types of lending today, as you've heard from other witnesses. As a consumer protection agency, we support strong consumer protection standards in the areas we regulate. I want to just briefly go over what some of those standards are today, and then raise just a couple issues for you. In insurance, with respect to insurance, insurance is regulated comprehensively at the state level. We don't have the issue of state and federal regulations, and we don't have gaps that the state can't regulate. We are the regulator for insurance. And there actually are statutes today that are the equivalent of the UTPA in Oregon law that are the sort of broad unfair trade practices type of statutes. And I've included them attached to my testimony. And some of the examples are a prohibition on making any statement misrepresenting the terms of any insurance policy or the benefits of or advantages of any insurance policy, employing any scheme, device, or artifice to defraud, obtaining money or property by means of an untrue statement of fact or an omission of a material fact, engaging in any other transaction or course of business that would be a fraud or deceit, untrue, deceptive, or misleading advertising, and then a catch-all provision similar to some of the other broad statements in the UTPA that says no person shall engage in this state in any trade practice that, although not expressly defined or prohibited in the insurance code, is found by the director of DCBS to be an unfair or deceptive act or practice in the transaction of insurance that's injurious to the insurance buying public. So in case of, in terms of the substantive standard, I think we have in Oregon, through legislation enacted in the past, very strong pro-consumer standards and good enforcement tools. And I do just want to briefly comment on the testimony of the gentleman from the collision industry. I'm not familiar with the specific situation and the specific parts that he was addressing. It is true that our services are provided to consumers, and I think this point was made by one of the insurance agents. We encourage collision shops when they contact us to have their customers contact us so that we can work with them. We do have a staff of consumer advocates who work regularly with consumers on their insurance problems. We get relief for those consumers on a regular basis. It's free. It doesn't require an attorney, and we feel it's pretty effective. One issue, though, is a lot of the complaints we deal with claims handling practices. That is not the sale of the insurance policy up front, but how a later claim is handled. And that's the gentleman from the collision industry was talking about a claims practice. We have in the insurance code an unfair claim settlement practices statute, as well as the unfair trade practices language. I don't believe that claim settlement issues would actually be covered under the UTPA. It deals with sales type transactions. So I don't believe that it would actually address the types of claims issues that that he brought up, even apart from what we do today. We exercise our rulemaking authority pretty aggressively when we see new issues coming up. Often those come up through our consumer advocates, and then we can investigate them. We have a staff of market conduct analysts who can look into practices in the market, and then we can take enforcement action or rulemaking action if we think that's appropriate. Some recent examples are suitability rules for life insurance and annuity products, which prohibit the sale of products which aren't suitable for a particular individual in light of their own financial circumstances and their age and their other needs. Recent rules prohibiting the use of professional designations that are misleading. So an insurance salesperson who holds himself out as a senior specialist or a retirement specialist when there are no professional credentials that actually back that up. We take aggressive enforcement action when need be. An example of how we have our enforcement tools, I should say, include the ability to impose fines, require disgorgement of profits. We can issue cease and desist orders. We can suspend or revoke licenses and certificates of authority. And we can seek criminal penalties when we need to. An example of how all these tools work together pretty recently was the enforcement action we took against Bankers Life for the sale of annuities to seniors that weren't suitable for their particular circumstances. We learned about that when we got a call into our consumer advocacy section. We then investigated it through our market conduct section. We found out a lot more about the insurance company's practices by overall. And then we ended up with an enforcement action that included restitution for the consumers who'd been harmed, a penalty of $150,000, revocation of a number of licenses of insurance salespeople who'd engaged in those practices, and most importantly, forward-looking, significant changes in the company's business practices so that we wouldn't be in that situation again. So that's how our insurance regulatory framework more or less works today. In the lending area, it's not as comprehensive. We don't have one overarching regulatory structure that applies to all lending. And as I think you've heard, we don't have the ability to regulate national banks. We're preempted from doing so. We do regulate state-chartered banks and credit unions, mortgage brokers and bankers, consumer finance lenders, payday and title lenders, and pawn brokers. The statutes vary somewhat, and they have differing degrees of specificity in their consumer protection. The area we've been spending the most time on most recently has been mortgage lending for obvious reasons. In my written testimony, I've gone through, and I won't go through with you, some of the statutory provisions. I think they've been mentioned by other witnesses that are, again, similar to the Unfair Trade Practices Act type of language. Broad consumer protections, broad anti-fraud provisions, prohibitions on misleading statements or deceptive acts, and, again, there is a private right of action in that for the state-chartered mortgage lenders. House Bill 3615 would do really three different things. One of them is it would apply a new set of substantive standards, similar in some respects, varying in some respects, governing the conduct that our statutes govern today. Secondly, it would impose a private right of action. And thirdly, it would give, as currently drafted, regulatory authority to the Department of Justice, regulatory and enforcement authority in these areas. And we do have significant concerns about having two agencies have duplicative and overlapping rulemaking and enforcement authority. We think in a regulatory avoiding confusion is important, clarity is important, and for a highly regulated area in general, we think it is preferable to deal with a single regulator so that we can set out clear expectations and give clear directives and then hold the industry accountable for meeting those. And I think this is particularly true with respect to insurance because it is a comprehensive regulation that's located at the state level only as opposed to the somewhat more fragmented area for lending. We do have staff with a great deal of expertise in these areas. We do believe it would, regardless of how you come out on the bill in the other areas, we think it would make most sense to leave regulatory and enforcement authority with DCBS for the entities that we regulate today. And we have told Representative Call that we're happy to work on whether there's language that could accomplish that, and we're happy to work with DOJ on that. There is no deal that I'm aware of, but I think that may be what Representative Call was referring to. So with that, I'm happy to answer questions or turn it over to Mr. Devanovich.
I'd like to go ahead and listen to Mr. Devanovich's.
Chair Halvey, members of the committee, my name is Keith Devanovich. I'm Chief of Staff and Special Counsel to the Attorney General. The issues that are before you are not in the statute, but primarily arise out of a couple of Court of Appeals opinion, and I'm talking about the loans and lending. And that is that the Court of Appeals decided that the terminology that was adopted when the ETPA was adopted does not include loans and lending. There is a specific provision in the UTPA that excerpts out or cuts out of the UTPA provision the business of insurance. So it would certainly be within your purview to modify the definitions of types of businesses that are covered by the UTPA. That having been said, there are essentially only two industries that are not covered by the UTPA, and that's banks and insurance industry. So doctors, lawyers, accountants, engineers, and architects in every other industry is underneath the UTPA. And most recently, this past year, the U.S. Supreme Court decided that states can enforce their state laws against national banks. And that's an important development because, as you're quite aware, we had a fiscal crisis that was caused by some national financial institutions. And as a consequence of the U.S. Supreme Court decision, attorneys general around the country have banded together to conduct a joint investigation of some of these financial institutions. Unfortunately, because the UTPA does not apply to loans and lending, the state of Oregon is not able to participate in that investigation. We received a complaint earlier today from a consumer in West Lynn who was falling behind on his mortgage. That person negotiated a short sale, which allowed them to avoid foreclosure, and the bank had indicated that they were willing to go along with a short sale. After a series of months and months that went by, the bank apparently changed its mind. In an email, internal supposedly, that we just received, a bank representative said, just let the guy hang. Well, that kind of representation or misrepresentation to the consumer and allowing the consumer to just hang out there is something that would normally be covered as an unconscionable act under the UTPA. But because loans and lending doesn't apply, is not covered by the UTPA, the consumer would have no right or remedy against that lending institution. We agree, the Department of Justice agrees with Ms. Streisinger. The Department of Justice is not seeking regulatory powers over banks and lending institutions and insurance businesses. That is not what we're seeking. We would not ask for that, and that is not, as my knowledge is, part of the bill. We think DCBS is doing a fine job in that area, and they should continue to do so. We also agree that DCBS should continue to be the lead enforcement agency over those entities that it presently regulates. And in other words, we are not seeking to also become an enforcement agency over the entities that they're already enforcing the law over. Last but not least, we think, however, there are certain entities that are not regulated by DCBS, for example, national banks. And we think that would be an ideal area for the UTPA to give powers to the Department of Justice to pursue claims against those kinds of national banks. And if the director of DCBS finds that a case against a local institution that it does regulate is appropriate for enforcement under the UTPA, upon referral to the Department of Justice, we would be happy to handle that kind of case. If there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
I'm going to start out with a couple of questions, perhaps, and maybe both of you can answer it. So, I'm kind of curious. We've explored the idea that obviously there are some lending financial industries that are not regulated in the state of Oregon, and that the insurance industry, from what I understand, is fully regulated in the state of Oregon if they operate here. So my question is there any instance that you can think of where action by the Attorney General under the UTPA would provide some sort of enforcement that wouldn't be available currently with the Department of Consumer and Business Services?
Mr. Chair, we've never in my time at the department come up with an instance where we felt that an insurance company or agent was engaging in wrongful conduct that we had no ability to address. We have strong enforcement tools. We have strong rulemaking tools. And so I'm not aware that there are situations where the UTPA would add to what we have now.
Mr. Dubanovich?
The Department of Justice wouldn't be aware of those kind of claims. If we get any inquiries about insurance, we immediately turn them over to the insurance division.
So, and a follow-up to my question. So, with most of the issues that come up around insurance companies, you had mentioned a difference between the claims part of the Act and, the trade practices part, and that claims potentially would not be, claims issues wouldn't be covered under the UTPA. My question is, because I don't think Mr. Dubanovich had commented on that, but certainly I'm curious if he agrees with you that the claims issues wouldn't fall under the UTPA. And then kind of curious is if you can give me a rough idea of how many of the issues or complaints that we would get on insurance companies are claims issues, essentially, compared to everything else.
Chair Holvey, I'll answer your first question, and hopefully Ms. Streisinger can answer the second. Members of the committee, I would agree that claims practices would probably not fall under the UTPA. Now, that could easily be remedied, which is to say that if it's a violation of the Insurance Claims Practices Act, it could also be declared to be a violation of the UTPA. If you look at the UTPA, there's a laundry list of cross-references to other acts, but that would be a separate piece of legislation that is not before you at the present time.
Thank you.
And, Mr. Chair, I'll have to get back to you with a rough percentage if you like, but I don't have that information today.
Okay, sorry, I could have probably let you know ahead of time I was curious about that, but sometimes I don't think ahead all that far.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Smith, question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Corey, thanks for your testimony. Are there, what are some of the other industries beyond banking, lending, and insurance that y'all regulate?
We regulate electricians and plumbers and the licensed trades. We regulate workers' compensation. We regulate workplace safety. And in the our financial sector, we regulate money transmitters, debt settlement companies. I know I'm missing a handful. Pre-need funeral trusts.
Appraisal management companies?
No, Mr. Chair, not appraisal management companies.
Mr. Chair, follow up. Mr. Dvanovich, thank you also very much for your testimony. What are some other industries, and you maybe gave a very quick list, or I know you gave a very quick list that I didn't track very well, but not just of other industries where the UTPA applies, but are there examples of very highly regulated, as I understand when the key advocates come to advocate against the bill, the key argument is, no, we're very highly regulated, we're a very highly regulated industry. Are there other examples of highly regulated industries that are subject to UTPA?
Well, I went through the laundry list, and I'll bet you if you ask doctors, excuse me, Chair Pulvey, Representative Smith, I bet you if you ask doctors, lawyers, architects, and engineers, they'd all say they're heavily regulated. So it's in the eye of the beholder. Certainly there are other industries, as Ms. Streisinger said, electricians, plumbers, and debt collectors are regulated, and they also fall underneath the UTPA.
One last follow-up. What about like telecom, energy? I'm thinking of the industries I know that are the most regulated. Telecommunications, very highly regulated. Energy companies, are these also covered by the UTPA or exempt in some other respect?
Chair Holvey, Representative Smith, yes, absolutely. They are covered by the UTPA.
Thanks.
Thank you. Representative Winger, question?
Corey, just a quick question about, I'm curious as to whether this bill would apply to SAFE and workers' compensation.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wingard, its application to workers' compensation is an interesting issue, and I understand there may be an amendment floating around to expressly carve out workers' compensation. I'll give you my best shot at it. This bill, the Unfair Trade Practices Act, generally applies to consumer transactions. Workers' compensation is a business insurance product, that it is not purchased by an individual. It is purchased by a business, although it benefits their workers. There is a carve-out to that restriction to consumer transactions for telephone solicitations. So the business impact of the UTPA is for telephone solicitations. Telephone solicitations under the UTPA expressly include insurance transactions, and this bill, as currently drafted, does not remove that carve-out. So I know that's about a triple negative there, but as I read the language as drafted today, it applies to consumer transactions, and insurance isn't included in the part that brings in some business transactions. I would therefore conclude that it probably does not apply to workers' comp, but on an excess of caution, I think there is an amendment being proposed that would exclude workers' comp.
Thank you.
Representative Matthews.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just think it's worth mentioning as things become public record and comments and whatnot that I just recognize your agency, or both agencies, I should say, for the work you're doing. Sometimes it's orchestrated as if citizens don't have any lever. I had asked your office, Ms. Streisinger, for some specific incidents, just a random, assortment. Just to give me an idea of what's been done in the past to egregious acts in the industry of insurance, mortgage, lending, finance, and I was quite impressed at the work that you've done. And so I appreciate that, and to your folks, too, please relay that. I do appreciate that. The one question I have, and there is a question here, Mr. Chair, thank you. Has this been an issue for DCBS? Has this been an effort you've been wanting to make under your charge? Is this something that was brought to you? And if so, how long Has this effort been going on? I'm trying to get a sense for why we're doing this now with just a little bit of angst. And I'm wondering from your standpoint of DOJ and DCBS, has this been something that's been a desire or a goal, or we've seen the need so we're just finally getting there, or where exactly are we?
Mr. Chair, Representative Matthews, this is not our bill, and we actually don't have a position on the bill at this point. So we have been responding to questions that came up. We became aware of the bill when it was presented to your committee in January.
Chair Holvey, Representative Matthews, the Department of Justice has looked at this issue in the past. It's my understanding that there have been previous efforts at expanding the UTPA. We likewise became aware of the bill, and I'm happy to provide any information to the committee about the bill.
And I only bring that forward, Mr. Chair, and thank you very much, because we had gone down the road of UTPA in last session. I was just curious how we missed this opportunity. So I appreciate that, and thank you for your time, and thanks for your efforts.
I have one final question that I'd like to ask, and I guess that is for a regulated entity that we currently have under statute, what kind of protections or remedies would be different for a consumer in the Unlawful Trade Practices Act under the DOJ as opposed to what we currently have under Department of Consumer and Business Services?
Chair Holvey, it's my understanding that presently there is no private right of action against an insurance company for wrongful practices. That is an action brought by DCBS, not by the consumer themselves. Presently, as you heard in the earlier testimony, there are some areas where consumers would have a cause of action against the financial industry, but they're fairly limited, and therefore the normal course of conduct that lawyers would pursue, the UTPA claim, is something that just is not used in the financial services industry at all. So therefore, the type of remedy that a consumer gets against a financial services company is much less. The recovery is much less. The remedy is much less. And frankly, more importantly, the UTPA gives courts broad authority to give injunctive relief that can prevent further harm from occurring. A lot of private causes of action just give money damages to the individual, but under the UTPA, a court has injunctive authority that is something that can be used to, again, prevent further harm.
And, Mr. Chair, I really can't speak broadly to what types of private rights of action are or aren't available. It's true that there is no express statutory private right of action under the insurance code. We do actually have broad cease and desist authority and broad authority to enter orders that accomplish much of what Mr. Dubanovich was referring to, though.
Thank you. So, well, to clarify, you are saying that DCBS does have the ability to seek a remedy for a consumer.
And, Mr. Chair, the banker's life example that I gave you was one that included monetary penalty, restitution, licensing sanctions against agents, and a stipulated order that changed the company's business practices on an ongoing basis.
Thank you. Not seeing any further questions from the committee, I really appreciate you wrapping it up, and even though I did allow you to go a little bit longer than 2 minutes, I think it was instructive for the committee to hear your testimony, and I appreciate that. I hope you recover from your illness so you can talk to us again. I hope that you might be able to also come back at such point as we have a work session on this bill. If, in fact, we do that.
Certainly.
Thank you. Patrick, it looks like we've exhausted our time,
yes,
committee. And it was mostly because some people asked a lot of questions. certainly we didn't make it through this agenda, so it's the chair's intent that we will be rolling over the entire agenda until Wednesday, minus House Bill 3659, which I believe we have moved out of the committee, albeit that is the only one.
3694.
So with that, committee, I believe we will adjourn. First, let me close the public hearing on House Bill 3615 and adjourn the House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Accountability.